This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Welcome back, everybody, to the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson. The People Speak Show normally airs every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network. You can participate during the show with calling questions for our guests toll-free in the USA and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. That number again, 1-888-429-5471. We're talking tonight to the author and political commentator from Montreal, Yves Engler. Welcome to the People Speak Show, Mr. Engler, sir.
Thanks for having me.
It's fantastic to have you. You've done a lot of really, really good work. You've written a lot of good stuff. And we'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour. But my first question to you, sir, is how did you get started into looking into politics and writing about it?
When I was 19, 20, I moved to Montreal to go to university. And it was a very, probably the most politically active student union in North America at the time, very serious left-wing student union. And it was in the midst of the so-called anti-corporate globalization movement of the late 90s, early 2000s. And I just sort of gradually got gravitated towards some of that activism. And then a few years later, after I'd sort of been politicized a little bit, I'd been elected into the student union at Concordia University. With regards to foreign policy, I was paying attention to what was going on in Haiti, and I noticed in early 2004, Canada helped overthrow Haiti's elected government, and I engaged in Haiti solidarity activism for a number of years and was disturbed by what Canada had done in Haiti, and it very much went against what I had sort of believed Canada was in the world, a sort of benevolent international actor. But in fact, Canada was, with Washington and Paris, had overthrown an elected government and supported a coup government that killed thousands of people. And basically, I sort of opened my eyes up to Canadian foreign policy. And since that time, I've written a number of books about Canadian foreign policy and Haiti very much politicized my understanding of Canada's role in the world.
So pretty much it was the turning point was the event in Haiti that woke you up to what was happening in the bigger picture in the world. Is that correct?
Exactly. So it's basically in the case of Haiti in 2004, it was the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration with Paris and Ottawa, basically orchestrated and executed overthrow of a government that was supported by the majority poor in that country. And what was amazing about the coup in Haiti was not just that it was Ottawa and Washington, but that there was, there was a media angle, the fact the media just blacked out any sort of critical information, the fact that the dominant media, at least, the fact that a lot of the so-called non-governmental organizations, which were being financed by the Canadian government, that they were complicit in the undermining of democracy in Haiti and were complicit in basically apologizing for massive human rights violations. So it was sort of all arms of the Canadian state. There was a military component. There were Canadian troops on the ground. There was Canadian police on the ground. There was an NGO component. There was the Canadian aid agency was heavily involved in backing this coup government. So it was really all arms of the Canadian state, and if what they did in Haiti, or if you could believe or sort of understand that they would do such a disastrous thing in such an impoverished place, it puts some big question marks on what our decision makers are doing, kind of everywhere in the globe.
Yeah, globally on a bigger stage. They're doing this everywhere, and they've done this everywhere to many other governments and many other countries. When you started looking into the past about how they manipulated governments and set up these coups, were you surprised? Was it an awakening moment for you to realize that Haiti isn't just a one-off? This is an ongoing agenda that started with, I believe it was a banana company in the Bahamas that started off doing this kind of deal where they crash local economies, they crash local businesses, they undermine government integrity. Was it a surprise for you to find out that they've done this before with things like Standard Fruit?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing. Going into the Haiti 2004 and the coup there, I had a little bit of understanding of U.S. imperialism, right? I'd read some Chomsky books, and I had a certain understanding that you know, Washington had done that in, you know, Guatemala in the early 50s, Iran in the early 50s, on and on and on. it was the Canadian angle that was a bit more shocking, and that's basically what I did after engaging in Haiti solidarity activism for about three years at a very intense rate and publishing a co-authoring a book on Canada's role in Haiti, I basically went to the archives and the libraries, the academic libraries, and basically said, well, if Canada had done this in Haiti, what has it done elsewhere? And then I spent multiple years researching the book, which was later titled The Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy. And basically it shows that the pattern, you know, Haiti wasn't just a one-off. It's a broader pattern. Canadian foreign policy is motivated by geopolitical interests, Canada's ties to historically the British Empire, today the American Empire, and corporate interests. That's overwhelmingly what drives Canadian foreign policy. And you can see it, you know, it basically, that's what drives Canadian foreign policy everywhere. I mean, there are mm. some minor exceptions within there. It's not to say that every single dollar of Canadian aid just serves corporate and imperial interests. There are examples of Canadian aid that are, you know, more of what the term aid would imply, which is that they, you know, actually, you know, help people. But the thrust, overwhelming thrust of the policy is in the direction of geostrategic empire interests and specific Canadian corporate interests. I was, you know, troubled. I still am. I learned new details every day of just the scope of things, the degree to which Canada has been involved in different places in the world in a nefarious fashion. And the way, you know, my most recent book is about the role of the media and the different academic institutions and the think tanks, their role in confusing people about Canada's role in the world, their role in, you know, suppressing information that's critical about what Canada is doing abroad, their role in, you know, creating these sort of fake debates between the extreme right-wing people who say we shouldn't send, in the case of what's going on right now in Canada, we shouldn't send Canada, you know, Canadian troops to the African continent because, you know, the African continent is just a mess. And then the sort of the liberal end who says he just has blindly supports anything that has a UN mandate behind it. So anything that's Canada supporting UN is ipso facto good. Wow. Because they call it peacekeeping, therefore it must be good. In fact, what happened in 2004 in Haiti was it was a UN peacekeeping mission that was keeping in place the brutal dictatorship that was, you know, killing thousands of people. So the point. So there are many facets to how Canadian foreign policy functions in the interests of corporations and in the interests of empire. You know, there's a media element to it. There's the role of the aid agency. There's the role of think tanks. On and on and on. So, you know, you learn new details and the scope and the depth of the problem, unfortunately, on a daily basis.
You know, you can't mention American or Canadian foreign policy without mentioning the Five Eyes, which is the intelligence sharing services of both Canada, the United States, the UK, and Australia, and their headquarters, which is in Tel Aviv, in Israel. Did you remember the statement or the policies that came out in the retrospective parliaments of Canada and Australia? Stephen Harper and John Howard, word for word, talking to their parliament about going to Iraq and going in to use weapons and bring troops in, but it was exactly phrased word for word in Australian and Canadian parliament. Do you remember that at all?
Yeah, well, there's a bit of a sort of a scandal over the plagiarism kind of scandal over. I believe it was Stephen Harper that plagiarized John Howard's speech, if I remember correctly. But it speaks to the
Let me stop you right there. That's not plagiarism. That's the Five Eyes handing down their policy for the governments that enact a policy. That's not somebody who stole a speech off somebody or copied it off the internet, cut and paste. That's somebody telling these governments to do exactly what they're told to do. Do you believe that's the case with Australia and Canada, that we take our orders from a higher source?
In a very broad sense, not really in a direct sense. Like, I think the communication security establishment, which is the part of the Five Eyes, you know, Canada's component to the Five Eyes, which is this. There's been a little bit of attention, media attention given to it. It was about now maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when there was a sort of scandal came up about how communication security establishment was spying in Brazil for some Canadian corporations. I forget all the details right now, but it was about some energy companies. They were also caught spying in the Canadian airport. This communication security establishment, and obviously, as you know, the Five Eyes, is this is something that's been going on for a long time. The communication security establishment is like thousands and thousands of employees at this office. They just finished building it or about to. Hundreds of millions of dollars spent on this, you know, top-notch security building that basically, until 2 years ago, 99.9% of Canadians didn't even know existed, even though there's getting hundreds of millions of dollars a year budget. Clearly, it's tied into a intelligence apparatus with allied countries that has, you know, a whole history going back, to the British Empire and the like. The idea that this is what's determining policy, I think it's taking place in a more indirect kind of way than passing orders down. It's more, these are our allies, this is our worldview, this is what we view as, you know, the elites in our country's view as serving their interests, and the policy is pursued like that rather than more sort of direct kind of sense.
Well, one of the common threads that both Harper and John Howard had in common, they both pandered to the Zionist policies, to Israeli policies, to send out Goyim blood, to send non-Jew troops over to get killed. Now, very, very interesting. Now that Stephen Harper and all of that Zionist influence has been washed out of the door in Canadian politics, do you see hope on the horizon with Justin Trudeau?
Well, first of all, I think that the formulation of non-Jewish troops being sent abroad I don't think that's part of what's driving these sort of policies. But in terms of Zionism goes in Canada. Zionism, Justin Trudeau is not as extreme in his Zionism as Stephen Harper. He is not going out of his way to make over-the-top comments justifying any policy that Israel pursues. But Zionism in Canada has been part of the establishment for more than a century. I mean, Zionism in Canada actually does not begin as a Jewish movement. It actually begins as a Christian movement. There's a Christian Zionist movement in Canada going back to the time of Confederation, 1860s. The preeminent Canadian Zionist this time. This is long before the first Zionist convention that Theodore Herzl called is a man by the name of Henry Wentworth Monk, who believed he was an Ottawa businessman. He believed that there should be a dominion of Israel as part of the British Empire. Right, so Canada was dominion, Australia dominion, and there should be a Jewish dominion part of the British Empire. And he actually campaigned on the issue for decades. And he claims, I don't believe this to be the case, but he claims he actually influenced Balfour's declaration. He wrote letters to Balfour and stuff. He claims he influenced Balfour's some biographers claim that he influenced the Balfour Declaration, which I think is probably exaggeration. But nonetheless, So Zionism in the early 1900s in Canada, certainly post Balfour Declaration, was tied into Canada being part of the British Empire and being a loyal dominion. And if you look during World One, it was a Canadian general that was even part of the conquering of Palestine. Obviously. Fighting with the British Empire during World War One, and there were hundreds of Canadians. There was actually a Jewish legion of troops that fought in 1917 to conquer Palestine from the Ottomans on behalf of the British Empire. So Justin Trudeau is he's still a staunch supporter of Israel. He's still a defender of Israel. He's not as extreme as Stephen Harper, but he is still definitely not somebody who is defending the Palestinian, the legitimate aspirations of the Palestinian people.
As much as he could be. I mean, let's face it, there's a long way to go for all Western countries to realize that has always been the land of Palestine. Just to clarify, too, I don't wish to make any anti-Semitic statements or anything like that. I see supporting any religion, I see that as supporting a football or a hockey team. Because you can chop and change that team support any time during the week, and you can change your support for any team you want. So I just respect them all, and I think good luck to them. Whatever you want to believe in, as long as it doesn't cause a murder, in the words of Frank Zappa, then go for it, you know, as long as it makes you happy. So I really don't care either way for any religion, but I do respect them all because they do have a place in our society, and I feel that people do need to cling on to a belief of something or some higher form or consciousness. So having said that, do you feel that much has changed in Canada in the last 20 years as far as society is gone? Because we've seen a huge change in Australia. We're seeing a massive change in the United States and, of course, England. There's so much change happening in all of these so-called Zionist satellite states. Can we call them that? I guess we can. I don't know. Do you feel that's a correct term to use, Zionist satellite states? And do you see much changing the same way we're seeing it changing in Australia?
Change. I mean, I think there's all kinds of different changes taking place in Canada. Some for the better. I think that the advancements on gay equality is a positive developments. I think there's some advancements in gender equality that are positive. There's also much worsening economic inequality, and the rich are getting richer, and the majority of us are either stagnating or getting poorer. And obviously, there's the big question of the direction of the capacity of this planet to for human beings to survive on this planet. That's clearly the one area that's probably getting worse in the kind of most rapidly and most dangerously. I think there's no doubt in terms of framing as Zionist satellite states. I certainly wouldn't frame the dynamic like that. I think there's no doubt that in Canada, as in the U.S., and I am not as familiar with Australia or Britain for that matter, but there is no doubt that there are pro-Zionist, pro-Israel lobby organizations, Jewish pro-Israel lobby organizations that are pursuing, what they perceive as being, good for Israel, and they have significant power and clout within Canadian politics or U.S. politics or probably in Australian and British politics as well. I don't believe that's the determining factor for support for Israel. I don't think that's the. There's a whole history of policies of Israel being viewed as an outpost of Western imperialism in the Middle East, and Canadian decision makers were very clear about that in the early 1950s, late 1940s, when Canada played a big part in creating the Zionist state. It's a bit complicated. There's different facets to it. I don't believe that Canada is a colonial power on its own, right? Long before the existence of the State of Israel, Canada had dispossessed First Nations and you know was and obviously Britain as well. In the last 20 years, have pro-Zionist political forces within Canadian society become stronger and more emboldened? For sure, I think that goes without saying, and I think that's also some elements of it in sort of paradoxically are a reaction actually to growing pro-Palestinian sentiment. There's some element of the extremeness of the pro-Israel stuff that's in fact a reaction to the fact that more and more of the population is aware that that Israel is a settler colonial state that continues to dispossess Palestinians in a brutal fashion and continues to destabilize the whole Middle East. So there's been some changes, and there's been some positive changes and many negative changes over the past two decades.
You know, Mr. Engler, I'm always left stunned at the amount of pro-Palestinian and pro-human rights work that comes out of a place like Montreal. It seems to be a gathering place for social justice warriors or activists. Do you see that a lot, that Montreal, apart from places like Ontario or other places in Canada, Montreal is a calling ground for this kind of pro-grassroots movements?
Without a doubt. I mean, Montreal is... certainly in the past, past handful of years, but probably going back maybe basically since the early 2000s at least, Montreal's been the most politically active city in North America. And obviously the student strike in 2012, where there was nightly demonstrations for, I forget the exact date and number, it was over 100 days in a row. There were demonstrations that started at 9 p.m. every night. Some of them I was on, some of them that reached up to into the tens of thousands of people. Was a very significant social movement, had quite an effect on consciousness. And there's been just a history over the past, going back decades of grassroots political activism on a number of issues that are related to accessibility of education, questions of accessibility of daycare, but also on international justice issues like some of the biggest protests against Canada's participation in the 2003 attack against Iraq took place in Montreal. There was, some estimates as many as 225,000 people in one of the demonstrations in a day that was minus 20. It was one of the coldest days of the whole year of already very cold winters in Montreal. And there was still, incredible numbers of people in the street. Obviously, the pro-Palestinian movement in Montreal is during 2014 when Israel was slaughtering people in Gaza. There was 10,000 plus people on the streets here. So it's unique in North America. And I think there's some cities in Latin America and maybe some cities in Europe that have and maybe in Asia and elsewhere, but that have this sort of vibrant kind of street protest culture and grassroots activism. Montreal certainly is at the forefront of that in North America.
Wait a sec. Let me just clarify this. You're an activist. You're a political activist that actually gets out there on the street and protests. You're also an author. You're also a columnist. You're also very well aware of the Palestinian and Zionist situation. My question is, how on earth did you get to write for Huffington Post?
That's actually kind of interesting. The way I got to initially write for Huffington Post was through, I was working for a labor union for a while, and actually I was writing op-eds for the president of the labor union. It was under his name, but I was writing them. He had a blog on Huffington Post. And so I was the one that would, post when it was written, I would post the blog on Huffington Post. And so I had, had some dealings with the editors at Huffington Post. And that's how I got my own blog. And I got to tell you, I actually have just a piece that just appeared today about Canada, the media's role in suppressing what Canada did in the coup in Haiti and some of the stuff post-coup. I've been suppressed many a times by Huffington Post. There's many, many, many blogs of mine.
Yeah, I'm thinking that.
Not been published for political reasons. There's sometimes there's they also the I think the more intelligent method is to actually just there's ways for them just to put it on the site but make it so basically no one ever sees it. That's the more intelligent way of sort of suppressing things. But there's in this article I just published today, this funny example where the Huffington Post editor told me in this this email because they asked you to link to you know sources to defend what you're saying, and I linked to two sources about this meeting where about the fact the Canadian government justified its intervention to overthrow Haiti's elected government in 2004 under the guise of the so-called responsibility to protect doctrine. That was a doctrine that was also invoked to justify the 2011 bombing and war on Libya. But they invoked it earlier, back in 2004, the Canadian government, the Liberal government, they invoked it to justify their intervention in Haiti. And we actually have the internal government files. Anthony Fenton, the co-author of the book of Canada's Role in Haiti with me, he actually did the access to information and got the internal files where the Canadian ambassador is referring to the responsibility to protect. And there's some other examples where they referred to it. I brought this up in the Huffington Post blog, and the editor said because I was linking to information that didn't appear, I couldn't find a link that appeared in a corporate media outlet. He wouldn't accept it as valid, even though I provided two links with the actual file. You can see the actual file. He still wouldn't accept it because it hadn't appeared in the corporate media. So I responded, of course, to him saying, "You have a policy of not accepting information that doesn't appear in the corporate media. Is that an official policy?" And he, of course, never responded to my question. But yeah, certainly, you know, Huffington Post is now it's part of a massive global corporation that's pursues the same sort of ideological view of things as most of the rest of the corporate media.
Yeah, 15 years ago or so, it was half decent. There was half decent articles there, but today. I'm surprised how a guy of your caliber can stomach writing for them. Let me just say that. But please do stick with us, sir. This is the People Speak Radio Show. I'm your host, Steve Johnson. We're talking with very special guest, Mr. Yves Engler, live on Internet Radio. And we'll be right back with our guest and audience questions after this short message break.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on BBS Radio.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the People Speak Radio Show, coming to you live across America, live across Canada, and live across the world on the BBS Radio Network in real time. I'm your host for tonight, Steve Johnson, and we're back with our very special guest, Mr. Yves Engler. I encourage all the listeners to visit his website at www.blackbook.foreignpolicy.ca. Welcome back there, Mr. Engler, sir.
Thanks for having me back.
Awesome. Can you tell me what's on the future? What book have you got planned coming up next? I've heard about your Black Book of Foreign Policy. You also mentioned another book. Can you tell us a bit more about that one?
I've done 6 books on Canadian foreign policy, and my 7th book on Canadian foreign policy, just coming in a couple weeks, actually, is called A Propaganda System, How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. And basically it looks at how the different sort of institutions that are sort of idea formation, so the military, the Canadian military spends hundreds of millions of dollars every year on PR work, on funding different think tanks, on funding academia, different academics and different departments, universities. Same thing, to a slightly lesser extent, the foreign affairs. Also, the Canadian Aid Agency has spent millions and millions of dollars over the years and annually. Also, I look at some of the role of people like Barrick Gold, Peter Monk, who was the former head of Barrick Gold, the biggest gold mining company in the world, and his role in setting up the Monk Center, the University of Toronto. Basically, a number of different major Canadian capitalists have spent significant money on building up different bodies that promote their view of international affairs. And then also I look at the media and just the way in which the Canadian media is particularly biased in its coverage of international affairs. I mean, they're biased in favor of power when it comes to domestic issues. They tend to, you know, back the business line on corporation line on most domestic issues. But when it comes to foreign affairs, the narrowness of the debate is particularly extreme. So it's basically trying to answer the question, why is it that 90% of Canadians believe Canada is a force for good in the world, even though Canada has long supported empire, has long supported Canadian corporations abroad? Why is it that so many people are so confused? The book attempts to answer that question.
Can you tell me how it is in Canada at the moment with the anti-BDS? Are they making laws and legislations to push pro-Palestinian movements and activist groups out of the window? Are they actually doing that at the moment in Canada?
Yeah, there's been some efforts on, the Parliament in February condemned the BDS movement, but it was a vote that really didn't, it was more just a sort of symbolic thing. There was an attempt in Ontario, the largest province in the country, to put forward a something that moved towards a bit more concrete repression of the BDS movement. That failed. That was voted down by the provincial government. There's attempts at, you know, university. I mean, just at McGill University, one of the universities here in Montreal, there's been some, they actually passed a BDS resolution. A student general assembly passed it, and then it didn't actually get confirmed in a broader vote, but it almost passed. And one of the things the students, some elements within the student government are trying to, I'm not sure the exact development in recent days, but basically try to make it so the student union can never, it's just like unconstitutional to even bring forward a vote to the student body on BDS because they claim it's singling out one country, and, you know, therefore it's sort of it's racist or whatever. So there's, you know, efforts to suppress it. My opinion is that obviously, these are, you know, sort of just it demonstrates how the supporters of Israeli policy really don't have arguments. They just have a power and the capacity to try to punish. They can't defend Israel's actions. So they just got to try to change the conversation or suppress the conversation. It's an attempt, but oftentimes I think a lot of this actually increasingly it's backfiring on the pro-Israel groups, because as the cries of anti-Semitism all the time get you know, people, are they, when you say it over and over again, that just because people stand up for Palestinian rights, that therefore they're anti-Semitic, it makes the whole term anti-Semitism lose its weight and lose sort of any sort of historic meaning. And in fact, now when I hear somebody's being called anti-Semitic, I presume they must be doing something good for the Palestinian cause. But you know, a lot of, I think increasingly the efforts are backfiring, and it obviously they're only doing these things because it's a reaction to the growing pro-Palestinian movement. Where that's going to, you know, all go, it's a little bit unclear at this point.
So just to call up a couple of things you just said there, these pro-Israeli groups seeing that attacking Israel is singling one country out. Isn't that a bit retarded? I mean, if we had that same idea about South Africa, we would never have boycotted South Africa. But their policies, their governmental policies, were just abhorrent. The same way we see Israeli policies are abhorrent. So isn't that slightly retarded to say, well, you can't single one country out, but you can if they're doing something wrong. Isn't that the point?
Yeah, no, I mean, beyond that, I mean, that obviously, that's, you know, that level. But beyond that, the irony of it is the people who seem to talk about can't just focus on one country, can't single one country out the most. They're the ones who would seem to be doing it the most. It's different, you know, pro-Israel groups that talk about people's, like, you know, obsession with Israel, but in fact they're the ones who are completely obsessed with Israel. They're the ones who will say anything to justify, you know, the 2,200 Palestinians killed in Gaza when there was, I think, was it 4 or 5 Israeli civilians, and it was, what, it was 1,800 or so Palestinian civilians, 4 or 5 Israeli civilians that are killed. You know, they'll defend that, and probably some of these groups will defend it. I wrote this at the time in 2014. Some of these groups, I always wonder what's the end point. You know, they'll support Israel if they kill 2,000 people in Gaza. Will they still support them if they kill 10,000 people? Or some of these groups would probably keep supporting Israeli policy if they killed 50,000. And then the real extreme types would probably keep defending Israeli policy if they wiped out the whole population of Gaza. So, yeah, you know, where is that? Where's the line at which their own obsession with Israel is, you know, singling out or whatnot? But yeah, no, I think the policies of Israel are indefensible at the level. So you have to focus on diverting the conversation to, you know, nonsense like singling out.
Exactly. Yeah, it becomes completely retarded. I agree. You know, it's interesting. Cynthia McKinney, former Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, exposed that you cannot be a senator nor a congressperson in the United States unless you sign a pledge of allegiance to Israel. That's a curious thing. Is that the same in Canada? Is there a similar kind of deal going there that you have to support the pro-Zionist? Otherwise, you just don't get in? Is that the way it is over there in Canada?
No, I don't think it. I don't think it's quite. I think there's definitely different dynamics in Canada. It's not as extreme as in the U.S. in terms of some of those dynamics with how the process of becoming a congressperson works. And I understand that, you know, in the case of Cynthia McKinney, the way she got lost her position was not because she actually lost in a vote. But it was in the primary, and pro-Israel groups backed an opponent, and they pumped a bunch of money into an opponent in the primary to oust her as in her within the Democratic Party. You know, Canada's electoral system operates differently. I don't think the political culture, as crazy the pro-Israel as Stephen Harper was, the political culture is still, I don't think, quite as extreme as the U.S., speaking very broadly here on the issue. So no, there's MPs. I mean, the NDP MP, the left wing party, who you know, she was somebody who you know, defended the Palestinian cause. Not wouldn't go as far as I, Libby Davies, a Vancouver MP. There was never even an attempt, really, not even a serious attempt to try to you know, take her out of parliament. There was an attempt to weaken her position within the NDP. She was then the second in charge of the party. But there was an attempt to weaken her position within the party. But they would never even think about trying to to defeat her in the Riding Association of Vancouver. It wouldn't even pose a group, or anybody wouldn't have even had a chance. You know, wins the seat, won the seat with. She just retired, but she won the seat with large amounts. Right now, I mean, the Green Party just passed a resolution supporting the BDS movement. The Green Party has one MP. The one MP opposes the BDS resolution. Is trying to rescind the BDS resolution. Is actually trying to organize a whole special convention to rescind this resolution that was just democratically passed in August. But the problem of my well, they may or may not defeat the resolution. But if the BDS resolution stays within the Green Party, Elizabeth May, the MP, there would be no attempt to try to get rid of her because it wouldn't be successful. So I think the Canadian dynamic is different than the Canadian dynamic.
Well, you know, in Australia, we have pretty much the same situation. We have a Green Party as well, but every time that they call or they put up a bill to promote Palestinians or to support the Palestinian cause, they get told off by ASIO. You don't go there, mate. You don't support those bastards. That's the sort of thing we're living with in Australia, where parties like the Green Party, they're told not to get involved. Don't get political or we'll investigate you. They actually get threatened by ASIO, the security state of Australia. Is that the same in Canada? Do they actually get threatened openly and publicly by the security state to shut their mouth?
No, definitely don't get it publicly. I mean, there's examples, and actually I have friends of mine who, CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, were going around talking to people about him. He was very involved in the pro-Palestinian movement. He helped coordinate, or he launched a big it was called Artists Against Apartheid. It got hundreds of, I think it was 500 different artists, Canadian artists, to support BDS movement, and they organized maybe two dozen concerts and shows and the like. His friends would talk to about his activism and stuff like that. So there's examples of that kind of repression. And he's a white guy, so the room for maneuver for the security intelligence was probably less than in the case of many Arab Canadians. And I think that there are obviously in Canada, most of the Palestinian political groups are banned terrorist organizations, right? The Canadian government has listed groups like the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine as a ban, obviously, in Hamas, and I think six or seven different Palestinian groups have been listed as terrorist organizations. So if you express sympathy for those groups, in theory, you can be pursued. There is things holding over people's heads on that front, but for the most part, the repression is a bit more subtle and less extreme on that front.
Right. Well, we have a question from Debbie in the UK who would like to know: is your book screwing the Canadian government? Is it actually making an impact?
No. I mean, in a sense, yeah. I think my books have increased understanding. Maybe among the sort of among the left in Canada of Canadian foreign policy and being more critical, but no, it's not making an impact. It's not coming close to determining policy the books, of course, don't get much. They get almost no attention in the dominant media, in the corporate media. So that's a big part of what impacts certain policies in the short term. I think that this has to be viewed as a much more long-term struggle than just like, okay, we need to have a book is published and the idea is you're going to stop the government's policy tomorrow. Now, first of all, books don't never do that. What does that is social movements, and that's people coming together and organizing and demanding change, and often that time that demands people you know, putting their bodies on the line at demands, people, you know, taking you know, very strong and persistent, committed political action. But more broadly for what I'm doing in terms of writing, I think it's, I see it more as like a long-term thing of you know, I said this one before, in the late 1800s, Canada ended the late 1800s with thousands of Canadians fighting on behalf of the British Empire to conquer or to solidify British position in southern Africa during the so-called Boer War. Canada ended the 1900s as part of NATO's bombing campaign in the former Yugoslavia. My objective, I see it more as like, let's hope that this, we don't end this century doing something similar. So it's very much a long-term, obviously you want to have as much impact in the short term as possible, but it's much more of a long-term political consciousness raising, building a totally different understanding about Canada's role in the world, and you know, convincing people in a longer term sense that these kind of policies are not right. First of all, they're immoral, but on top of that, I don't think these policies are ultimately even in most Canadian self interest, because it's making for a more unequal world. It's making for a more violent world. It's making for makes it difficult to overcome problems like climate change, etc.
You know, if there's one thing I've learned over the years, and I've certainly learned this from the Indigenous author in Australia, Kate Howarth, that if you believe in what you're doing and if you stick to your guns and you keep going and keep going, you will eventually one day change the law with what you believe and the books that you write, and the things that you write are so powerful. People will start to take notice. I believe that. Do you believe that's the case with your books?
Yeah, I mean, I think it, obviously, if it's individuals can't do that much on their own, but many individuals doing a little bit, be that, you know, writing books, be that hosting a radio program, be that going to a demonstration, be that trying to, you know, stop a pipeline, be that, you know, whatever the, you know, collectively, if everyone pitches in a little bit of their time and ingenuity and knowledge, that, you know, we can change it. Also, I think in the case of, you know, my case, you know, I'm not somebody who, as many people in this world, has to, you know, be out, you know, tilling fields so I can have food at the end of the day. I have a certain degree of privilege in terms of being able to spend time to do this writing and research and stuff like that. You know, I'm not living a life of hand to mouth. So there's that kind of privilege brings with it a degree of a sort of, I guess, responsibility. You know, so I think that and you know, many people and probably many listeners are you know, similar situations where, yeah, okay, you know, if we could you know, work, you could take that job that pays a little bit better so I can have a slightly fancier car, or I could buy a, you know, slightly whatever the newer thing that the advertisements are telling me I'm supposed to want, or I can, you know, maybe, you know, work a little bit less at the formal job, but spend a bit more time on trying to figure out the world and trying to make the world a better place. And I think that, you know, at this time in human history, there's a fair bit of people that are in a position where they can take that time to try to figure out what's going on in the world, and take the time to, you know, to ameliorate things. And they, you know, their consequences on them won't be that significant. And I think that there's a sort of moral responsibility to a large extent to try to do that.
Mm. Right, right. Fantastic answer. We have a question from Ree in Manitoba who would like to know, does Kevin Trudeau do what Obama tells him to do? Do you think it's as simple as that?
No, I don't think it's as simple as that. I mean, I think there's clear examples where Trudeau, bows to U.S. pressure. I mean, I think that Canadian, fighter jets and troops and Iraq and Syria, they withdrew the fighter jets They still maintain some, you know, refueling for the American mission, and still there's still some Canadian aircraft involved. But they withdrew the fighter jets that they promised to do in the last election. But what they did to placate Washington was then to ramp up Canadian special forces. Right, so now there's more than 200 Canadian special forces. So, and that was, I think, pretty much under pressure from Washington to you can withdraw
right
on that front, but ramp up over there. So I don't think it's quite one to one. Canada's not, you know, just a colony of the U.S. I think the big
wait a sec. Can I just stop you there, Eve? You said to ramp up Canada's special ops division, the special covert missions. Does that mean they get more than nine people in their group now?
More than nine people in the Canadian Special Forces?
In the unit, yeah.
No, they have. I don't know about the per unit level, but previously I think there was about 60 or 70 Canadian Joint Task Force 2 on the ground in Iraq, but now it's over 200.
I thought there were only nine globally. I thought there were only nine special forces in Canada globally.
No, there's a perception out there that that the Canadian military is, it's just the peacekeeping, whatever. But there's a major Canadian special operation. I mean, that's one of the things that's happened over since the early 2000s is the Joint Task Force 2 was created. That's the elite of the elite. There's no official number publicly available, but I think it's in something in the range of like 600. And then there was a second Canadian Special Operations Regiment, that has a comparable number, and that was created started being created in the mid 2000s, I think it's 2006 or so. And I think the CSOR, Canadian Special Operations Regiment is something with all, like, the support staff and stuff, something in the range of 2,500.
They don't even have enough to make a hockey team, surely.
No, I have seen.
I got to tell you, Eve, I'm sorry to butt in here. I have seen Day Job Orchestra. I do know that Canada is the next Iraq. As soon as the Americans work out the coal tar sands are worth money, they're going to invade you guys. I'm telling you.
Yeah, we'll see. The relationships between the U.S. corporations and Canadian corporations are so tight. There's no need to invade. People can get the profits out of the tar sands just by backroom deals by different buddies. That's been basically the relationship for the past century. But no, the Canadian Special Forces. I mean, the whole point of the Special Forces. Important for those listeners to know is that it's because they're secretive. I mean, the reason they ramp them up, it's basically in part, it's a PR tactic. Part of it is that they are more elite fighters, and so they're, you know, better at killing people. But the other part of it is that everything takes place and the public never knows about what's happening. And there's only a few instances the special operations will release information they want the media to know about, of course. But there's only a few instances where we actually hear, information they don't want the public to know. There's one book it's called Nous étions invincibles. So we were invincible, a French-speaking JTF-2 soldier, where he talks about being inserted into Colombia. He talks about being inserted into the Congo, the Eastern Congo, where this crazy mission to bring a Canadian general to meet a rebel commander in 1996, and they come under fire, and they're helped. They only get out of it because the American Apache helicopters back them up. He talks about the Canadian JTF-2. There's reports that they were on the ground on the night when Aristide, Haiti's elected president, was ousted and physically removed, in his word, kidnapped by U.S. Marines, that the Canadian troops, the JTF-2, were in charge of, were securing the airport that Aristide says he was kidnapped from. So there's obviously in Afghanistan, there were involved those nighttime assassination raids. So there's this is just what we know of. This is just some of the details that have come out of their operations, which is disturbing, just what we know.
Right, right. Have you seen a mass exodus of Americans going up the north border since the elections have been announced? Like lately, with Americans faced with the contention of either Hillary or Trump, I believe a lot of people are just saying, no, screw this, we're out of here. You seen a lot of Americans lately in where you live?
I have, but that's because the Canadian dollar has dropped a bunch against the U.S. dollar, so all the Americans come up to Montreal in the summertime because Montreal is the place to be in the summertime. But no, not yet in terms of exodus. But maybe if Trump wins, there will be some exodus. But I'm guessing that Hillary is. Hillary is probably a little bit worse than Obama, but Obama's not so good either. So, I don't know that if Hillary wins, that things will change that much internally within the U.S. Yes, she's a little bit more hawkish than Obama, but Obama's already a pretty violent
character. Oh yeah, I'm still waiting for the hope and change, hoping that something's going to change, but nothing ever does.
it's last week of office. I think it's coming.
Oh, right, gotcha. Well, you've been listening to the People Who Speak show with a very special guest, Eve Engler, and I'd like to thank him and remind all the listeners to visit his website at www.blackbook.foreignpolicy.ca. Thanks so much for being on the show today, Mr. Engler, sir.
Thanks for having me.
God bless you, and hopefully we can have you back here again. Stay tuned for special guest Rex Gilroy coming up soon on the People Who Speak show. Big thanks go out to the producers, Mike, Doug, and Donald, to the admins, Love is Light, to Astral, and of course Earthplay, and all the guys who give me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. You can tune into my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel. But for me for now, take care, and ciao until next time.
One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the steeple, by the relief office, I saw my people. And they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.